During the Wednesday evenings this month, we're talking about strengthening the church at home. This is an assignment given to me by the congregation here with a number of issues and questions mentioned for the various evenings. And this evening we need to talk about how do we teach our children to have a passion to serve God? What is the church's responsibility in the spiritual teaching of our children? I'd like to begin tonight by reading to you a little statement that I found many years ago, and I think it makes a point. It's called, Where's Your Little Chick? Once upon a time, there was a papa rooster and a mama hen. They had a cute little baby chick. They were the proudest papa and mama you ever did see. This little chick's never going to have to scratch out his living like I did, declared Papa Rooster. We shall see that he has everything he needs to grow up and be a fine chicken. And they did. They worked their beaks off, trying to provide the finest things for their little chick. He wore the shiniest feathers in the whole chicken yard. They taught him the finest manners and allowed him to associate with only the best chickens. I want was all the baby chick needed to say, and his want was provided. The other chickens were so envious that he had parents who took such pride in the meeting of his every wish. In chicken school, he was always the leader. He led in reading, writing, and arithmetic. He played both chicken football and basketball and held down first chair in the school crowing choir. He was the valedictorian of his chicken class and was voted the chicken most likely to make tracks. He went to Barnfowl University and continued his education. Once there, he again performed brilliantly, and Papa Rooster and Mama Hen bought him a slick convertible to show the pride that they had for him. He graduated with honors and finally earned a master's degree in coopology. He met a cute little chick co-ed and was wed in an elaborate barnyard affair that had the hen house talking for weeks afterward. His career seemed assured and his future seemed bright. But one morning, tragedy struck. He disappeared and was never seen again. The last anybody ever saw of him, he was tucked under the arm of a very hungry-looking hobo who was headed for a campfire down by the railroad tracks. Alas for little chick. His parents did everything for him except the one thing that was absolutely needful. They never did teach him how to save his own life. Of course, the moral of this story is that unless your child learns about the Lord and learns all that he can about how to save his soul, he doesn't have a chance. The world is a very hungry hobo. Jesus placed a great priority on children. He gave a weight of responsibility to those of us who are parents. He said, Suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. He said that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father. And he said, If you cause one of these little ones to stumble, it would be better for you not even to have been born. So we get the impression from the Bible, Old Testament and New, that the way we treat children is very important. Maybe the most familiar verse in the entire book of Proverbs is train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22:6. That expression, train up, is a word that was used for the mouth or the inside of the mouth, the palate and the gums. It had to do with the breaking of a wild horse, bringing it into subjection by a rope in the mouth. It had to do with the action of a midwife soon after birth in those days. Soon after the birth of a child, she would dip her finger in some chewed up or crushed up dates. And with that juice, she would rub into the mouth of that infant, massage its gums and its palate to create a tangy sensation, to create a hunger and a thirst, a sense of sucking, and then place that baby in the arms of its mother. Train up has to do with something very early or something all through the time that that child is a child. The word child in Proverbs 22:6 is sometimes used of a newborn infant, as of Samuel in 1 Samuel 4. It's also used of an infant not yet weaned in 1 Samuel 1. It's used of Ishmael when he was in his early teens in Genesis 21. In Genesis 37, it's used of Joseph when he was 17 years of age. And it's used in Genesis 34 of a child that was considered to be of marriageable age. So the word child is used in the Old Testament all the way from birth up to marriageable age. Train up a child in the way that he should go. In means in keeping with or in cooperation with, in accordance to. And the way has to do with his characteristics, not just a path, but in Proverbs 30, verse 18, for instance, it has to do with characteristics. The expression is derek, D-E-R-E-K, taken from Hebrew letters into English letters. And it's not always a pathway or a road, but can have to do with characteristics or the manner of somebody. Train up a child according to his characteristics. In Psalm 11, verse 2, the idea there is that the wicked bend their bow. That's the verb form of the same expression that's used here. So that I think what's being said in Proverbs 22 and 6 is, train up a child according to his bent. In every child, there is a bent already established before you ever even see the child. That child is not necessarily precisely like a pliable piece of clay when it first comes into your hand. He already has a bent that is set. He already is sort of programmed in a definite way. Now, it's not a complete pre-programming, of course. In fact, we as humans have less of that pre-programming than animals do. Animals are almost entirely pre-programmed according to instinct. But yet, as human beings, we do have some of this. And the parent who wants to train his child correctly discovers that bent. When we find a child, even when it's newborn, we begin to discover things about that child as it begins to mature. One child is creative, another child may be almost entirely practical. One child is submissive by nature, another is aggressive by nature. One child is intelligent, another child may be rather dull. One child is always curious and absorbed in something, another child may be somewhat vacuous and easily bored. One child seems innovative, another child may be imitative. One child is competitive, another child is by nature cooperative. One child is a joiner, another child is a loner. One child is pugnacious, another child is timid. Know the way that child is made, because as we know, they're not alike. If you have a family with more than one child, you know that they're not alike. Biblical examples could start with the first children in the Bible, Cain and Abel. Now, Cain and Abel were brothers, and they may possibly have been twins. I don't say that they were. But have you ever thought about the possibility that Cain and Abel were twins? It reads like that's possible to me. Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived, and then she gave birth to Cain, and then it says she gave birth to Abel. It doesn't talk about knowing her again or her conceiving again. They may possibly have been twins, but whether they were or not, they were definitely brothers in the same family, and they were different as night and day. Jacob and Esau, we know, were twins, and they were different as night and day. One of them was a conniving little sissy, and the other was a He-Man type of hunter. But they came out on the same day from the same mother, yet they were bent in different directions. Absalom and Solomon had the same father and the same basic court life, but one of them grew up to be a rebel, and the other was a man of peace. It's the father whom God places the primary responsibility for the rearing of the child. The father is told not to provoke his children to wrath, but to bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. So when we look at this question that I was asked, what is the church's responsibility in the spiritual teaching of our children? It's not really the church's responsibility. It's the father's responsibility, assisted by the mother in the process. But the buck stops with the father in the family when it comes to the spiritual teaching of our children. Now, if the church wants to have classes and VBSs, that's all well and good. I don't think that'll hurt the children too much, since there won't be that much learned there anyhow. It's just practically impossible for the church to do the job that the parents are supposed to do. It's great for the church to have organized events to try to teach the children and help them have time to be together. That's all good. I'm for all of that. But that's not the church's primary responsibility. It's the Christian father's responsibility to see that this is done. So I'm glad that question was asked so that I can express myself upon that. It's the father's responsibility, and the father should not necessarily use the same approach with all of his children. We definitely should not compare our children, at least not verbally, to them. We ought not to compare our children. Judy, why can't you be more like Debbie? And then go into a long rant about how good Debbie is and how Judy's not so good. Why can't you live up to the way your sister is? Well, Debbie probably has, or Judy probably has something that Debbie doesn't have as well. We need to look for the good. And I'm just selecting names randomly. I hope you know, I understand that. There's no Debbie in this congregation that I know of. We've got a visitor here named Debbie, but nobody's looking at her. Oh, that's right. Thank you. Yes. Moving right along. I'm not saying that children should be allowed to run their own way. In fact, I'm saying quite the opposite. I think it's unwise to compare the two and to try to fit them all into the same cast, and especially it's unwise to allow them to think that that's what's being done. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old. The word old there in Proverbs 22 and 6 refers literally to hair on the chin. It refers to a bearded one. It's the idea of maturity there. When he is old, he will not depart from it. We're all familiar with the 139th Psalm. We often speak of it in discussions about when babies begin to be formed and begin to be a viable life and so forth. There's a lot there about being woven together in the womb and how unique each individual is. If God has given you a child, you have been given a great gift. And each child is distinct. Each child is designed and fashioned by God as a unique model. There are certain inborn, God-given talents, abilities, makeups, a certain set of attributes in each child. No two are alike. And the parents, by study and observation, discover the child. That process does not stop. The parent is a student of the child and of the bents of his child as long as the child is in the parent's care. The chances are that your rebellion as a child began when you felt that your parents did not understand you. Your child's rebellion may begin when they sense that my folks just don't understand the way that I'm made. I'm willing to be developed, but they don't understand what is inside of me. They don't understand how I'm made up. And so, as parents, you use brute force and that alone, and the child turns within and develops a hatred for many things. And you say, perhaps, well, I'm training him as the Bible says. But we need to be sure that we understand that step number one is knowing the child. And no amount of discipline or spanking in the scriptural sense is going to be successful if we fail to know our children. Proverbs 29:15 says, "The rod and reproof give wisdom." But a child left. How many children are left today? A child left bringeth his mother to shame. So there is correction, and there ought to be. But there are also bents. Bents that need to be channeled into productive areas and channeled away from problem areas. Train up a child according to his bent. The good things in that child you enhance and develop and reinforce and make provision for by equipment that will enhance, etc. And the bad you try to counteract. The bad may be something that was bad in yourself or your spouse or in both of you. We tend to pass down these traits. When the question is asked, as I already read, how do we teach our children to have a passion to serve God? The very first way you do that is by having a passion to serve God yourself. And you're not going to be able to fake that where your children are concerned. You may fake the brethren out, and you could possibly fake yourself out, but you're not going to fake your children out on that kind of an issue. Not over time, not living in a home. A Christian home can be a breeding ground for cynicism if there is hypocrisy going on there. Train up a child according to his bent. And if you're like old Abraham and you're a liar, It's easy to pass down that characteristic to Isaac. Isaac not only lied as well as his father, but he lied in almost precisely the same words. In fact, everything that Isaac did that we're told about in his life was pretty much a duplicate of the way his father had done. And then Jacob became a past master at the same art. He lied just like daddy, just like grandpa, and with a little help from mom. So we pass it on. We can talk about Judah and his generation and go right on down through and see these characteristics pass by. I think what Proverbs 22 and 6 is saying as a general rule, and by the way, there are many general rules in the Bible. I'm not saying this is hard and fast in every case because I may have well have known of some exceptions. But there are general rules like Proverbs 22 and 6 saying that the child will not depart from the training he received because he will be in a measure the product of that training. The home is the place where life makes up its mind. So when we talk about raising these children, we need to realize that the way we do that is to first of all have a genuine relationship with the Lord, ourselves. This cannot be successfully faked. It needs to be real. And also, a recognition of what we talked about last week, and I don't know if we explicitly said this, but it was implied, at least, when we looked at Ephesians 5 last week. Children are not even mentioned in that passage, but it's the premier passage in the New Testament on the subject of marriage. The most important relationship in the family remains the marital relationship. That's what produced the children to begin with. One of the best things a man can do for his children is to love their mother and for the children to know that there is love in that marital relationship. The quality of the parent-child bond is somewhat dependent on the quality of the marital bond. So we need to give attention. And we talked about this extensively last week from Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter chapter 3. We got interrupted in the middle of our discussion of 1 Peter 3:7, but we're starting to run out of nights, so I didn't go back to that tonight. Went on the sheet that I've been given. But I hope enough was said to make the point that the marital relationship is the fundamental, foundational relationship in the home. If we don't get that right, we need to correct it, because unless it's corrected, probably detriment is going to be done to the children and their view of themselves and their lives and the world. And then, based on those two ideas, a firm passion in ourselves for the Lord and a firm marital relationship as an environment in which the children can thrive, then we need to really love our children in an unconditional way. We love them, and with all that that implies, and love is a big word, as you know. We need to constantly remind ourselves that they are children and that they will tend to act like children and that much of childish behavior can be unpleasant. If I do my part as a parent, then I hope that they will be able to mature and give up their childish ways. Foolishness is bound in a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. The right use of that rod is very biblical and good. The wrong use of that rod can be disastrous. So we need to use it, but we need to use it with finesse. We need to understand that there are other ways to discipline as well. Now, children are not as cognitive as they are emotional. And this is true especially in the very early years. They come into the world very emotional being. The child is so sensitive to the feelings of its mother. My daughter was telling me on the phone just the other day that when she's getting ready to go somewhere, there's some kind of tension about getting ready or something, that her baby can sense that. The baby isn't told with words. He wouldn't even understand words, but he can sense when his mother is sensing something. He can sense it as well just from being with her, just from seeing how the muscles in her body are a little different than they might be on a normal occasion. A newborn infant brought to its mother for the first time, if the child truly wants that child, the infant can tell this right away. He conforms to the mother's body, and his contentment in most cases becomes obvious to all. A mother who does not want her baby, the baby tends to nurse poorly and frets and is unhappy. Children are extremely sensitive emotionally. A child is constantly asking his parents, "Do you love me?" Now, they're not asking that with words, but they're asking that with their behavior. And we give that child the answer by our behavior. Our children are like little mirrors. They reflect love, but they do not tend to initiate it, at least not at first, because they're just like us. But we're told by the Apostle John that we love the Lord because he first loved us. And our children are often much that same way. If love is given to them, then they return it. If none is given, then they have none to return. Debbie Pride pointed out a book to me the other day about serial killers, which I've been taking a look at. You look at some of the awful childhoods of some of these people who grew up to be serial murderers, and you can see that it just looks like some of them almost never had a chance. I know that that's not true because we do make our own decisions. But when you see just, I mean, some of the childhoods that people are caused to endure, I wouldn't even want to try to explain to an audience like yourselves. It's just an awful thing. And they grow up to be reflective of that kind of a rearing. So we need to understand that the rearing of these children is very important. It deserves everything good that we can put into it. And unconditional love reflected unconditionally. Conditional love returned conditionally. We see both of these in a number of examples. Now, there are an awful lot of children around these days, perhaps more than ever, who do not feel genuinely loved by their parents. Yet really, there are relatively few parents who do not love their children and even love them dearly. I think there are a number of parents who just do not know how to genuinely convey their love to their children. The Apostle John wanted to make sure that we do not love just in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. So how can we put our love for our children into action? Many children of Christian parents are well disciplined, or at least they're disciplined. They're strongly disciplined at times, but yet they can in some cases tend to feel unloved. And they may be well behaved when they're young and maybe even seem a little overly passive or quiet, somewhat sullen perhaps, or withdrawn, lacking in spontaneity, lacking in expressions of curiosity, lacking in the exuberance that we sometimes like to see. Sometimes they become behavior problems as they approach and enter adolescence because they lack a strong emotional bond with their parents. So how can we achieve that? This is all about raising children who can be passionate in their love for the Lord. How do we give them a firm foundation? One of the ways we do that is by having lots of eye contact with them, not just when they're in trouble. One of the ways that parents can miss the boat a little bit, I think, is to mainly have eye contact with a child when that child is in trouble or when we're trying to discipline that child. But I'm talking about lots of eye contact at other times. One of the things that struck me the most when our first baby was born and little baby Amber was handed to me by the nurse was this pair of searching eyes. They were going around that room, darting here and there, looking for another set of eyes to connect with. And when she saw my eyes, she just connected, and she just kept her eyes on my eyes. And I just started imagining all kinds of things that were going on in her little brain. It's like, and I remember having the sense that she was saying to me, "Are you ready for this?" And I didn't know if I was ready for it or not, but I knew I loved her, and I knew immediately we were connecting through the eyes. This is often, you know, they talk about eyes being windows of the soul. Well, that's not scripture. But there is this connection that we have through the eyes, and we ought to have that with our children. Eye contact in the pleasant times, looking directly into one another's eyes. Good communicational contact, fulfilling emotional needs. I don't think most people realize how crucial eye contact is. Try to converse with somebody who won't look at you. I think a number of you know that my wife and I have a son who is schizophrenic. His name's Dylan. A lot of you know him. He's been here lots of times through the years. But he's schizophrenic, and one of the symptoms of that is that he doesn't want to look anybody in the eye. He can just hardly stand eye contact. Makes conversing a lot more difficult when you can't look or you won't look at somebody or they can't look at you. Our feelings toward that person can be affected by this. If parents give loving eye contact only under certain conditions, like a disciplinary condition, I think that's a mistake. It's easy for us to develop that habit, however. Looking at people is important. Making that connection is important. Remember in the Gospels, the statement was made at a certain unfortunate point in Peter's career. Jesus looked at Peter. That's not in there by mistake. And that look, without words, must have spoken volumes. So that's one thing to keep in mind that I think is important. It helps to establish this relationship, this connection that we want. Use eye contact as a continuous, love-giving route. Smile while we have that eye contact, not just as a means of discipline. One time Dylan was on a baseball team out in Greenwood, and there was a kid on his team that would never look at me, no matter what we were saying, talking about, even if there was no problem. He just would never look at me, or sometimes he'd glance at me and then look away. When I met his father and saw the way they interacted, then I could understand why the child was the way that he was. In fact, I'll tell you this, when I was teaching school, we'd have back-to-school nights, and I'd only known some of those kids for a little while. But as the parents came in for back-to-school night, I could almost tell you which set of parents belonged to which kid, just because the kids were so much like the parents. Our babies, they seem to be searching for another set of eyes. In addition to eye contact, I think also just physical contact is a good idea. It seems that sometimes, and especially as they grow older, we may want to touch our children only when necessary. But it's such a simple thing to touch a child on the shoulder or poke them in the ribs a little bit. I don't think that we should try to keep physical contact to a minimum with our children. This is a natural thing. It should be a comfortable thing. But it may take some relearning on our part if we weren't raised in a family that had some physical contact. We don't want it to be showy or to be overdone. But every little baby born, I believe, needs to be held and cuddled and fondled and hugged and kissed. This is just what they need. There's been research done on this. The research on the way, by the way, on this says that infant girls less than a year old receive five times as much physical affection as infant boys. Boys 3 to adolescence have many more problems than girls do, 5 to 6 times as many problems. 5 to 6 times as many boys as girls are seen in psychiatric clinics around the country, and there may be a lot of reasons for that. And that ratio changes later during adolescence. But all of our children need some physical contact with us. Boys need to be wrestled. They need to be slapped around a little bit in a fun way. I'm not talking about slapping in the face in a disciplinary way. I don't mean that. But just to be, you know, I don't want to say knocked down. But just have some roughhousing. That's what I'm trying to say. Boys need that. And we need to be willing to take our glasses off to protect them and just roll around on the floor a little bit with the boys. But boys and girls also need physical contact. Children need physical contact when they've been hurt, physically or emotionally, or when they're tired or sick or sad. Just some physical contact, maybe even without words sometimes, might help. Our children so quickly pass from one stage of their development to another, almost before we know it sometimes. And these opportunities to give them what they need come and go. And it's too bad when we let those stages go without embracing them while they're there. Girls in particular need physical contact with their fathers right up through their adolescence. And a lot of fathers have trouble with this when the girls begin to mature sexually. It's like they feel like they shouldn't touch them anymore because, well, there's so much talk in our day about sexual abuse, and that is a big problem, of course. But our girls need us to hug them maybe even more when they're going through puberty and facing those times. Everybody wants physical contact. She's probably going to get it somewhere. She needs it from her daddy when she's 13, 14, 15 years of age, getting her sexual identity at that age, even partly from her relationship with her father. So this is a very important thing. Many religious cults have been able to capitalize on the fact that parents are not physically accepting of their children in many cases. And the Moonies, as one example of that, would take people in and embrace them and say, we have time for you, we'll take care of you, and even when the parents would not. I stress these things because I believe that we do love our children. Sometimes we're just not aware that we need to convey our love to our children. We sort of begin to assume that our children know that we love them. Or just like a husband, it's easy for him to assume that his wife knows that he loves her. But when somebody told the story about a man that had been married for 50 years and his wife said, "You never tell me you love me." And he said, "Well, I told you the night we got married that I love you. And if anything changes, I'll tell you." So this needs to be reaffirmed. We need that reaffirmation. So before anything else, before all the Bible and teaching and guidance and example and discipline, we have to have that unconditional love as the foundation for it, thus be the basic relationship with a child, or other things become a lot less predictable. Eye contact and physical contact seldom require real sacrifice by parents, but focused attention does, and that's what I'd like to talk about next. Focused attention. This requires time, and it may mean giving up something that the parents would rather do. Loving parents are going to see times when their child desperately needs their focused attention at a time when the parent least feels like giving it. The parent is so tired, there's so much other work waiting, and yet the words of the Lord come echoing down through the years, "Suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." Focused attention is giving our full, undivided attention. That's tough if you have multiple children. But I think each one of our children deserves focused attention that lets the child know that he or she is valuable enough in his or her own right to warrant the parent's undistracted watchfulness and appreciation for a while. Focused attention makes a child feel that for that time, for that moment, those few moments, he is the most important person in the world in the parent's eyes. A child ought to be made to feel that he is one of a kind, that he is unique, he's different from all the others in the family and in the world. That each child needs to feel that they are special, because that's true. They need to feel that truth, not just cognitively know that truth, but they need to feel that truth. Focused attention is maybe the most demanding need that a child has. We parents tend to have a difficult time recognizing it, let alone fulfilling it. It's difficult enough just to recognize it. Other things we do for the child seem to suffice very often. Ice cream and candy and gifts and new clothes, these things seem to substitute for focused attention at the time. And these other kindnesses are good. I don't mean to demean them. But it's a serious mistake to use these other things as a substitute for genuine focused attention. And it's hard to make that change. One man in the church in another state told me that he knows he substitutes things for focused attention where his children are concerned. He told me that a few years ago, but he's still doing what he was doing at that time. The change has not been made. It's a tough change to make. Why is it so difficult to give focused attention to your children? Because it takes time. And you've got a ringing telephone. You've got to just establish priorities. You can't get everything done that's on your list. You just need to decide what matters the most. And while your children are growing up, they're not going to wait for anybody. Babies don't wait. They're developing whether you're paying attention or not. So I think most of us who have raised our children, while we're going through it, it seems like it's never going to end. They're always going to be in some obnoxious stage or the other. But then after it's over and you're looking back, boy, that went quick. Where'd all that go? So it's all a matter of perspective there. The key, one of the great keys to life, I think, is to embrace each stage of life while you're living it. Do what needs doing. Not be looking back for, "Oh, I wish I was in high school again." And who would wish that? I don't know. But I've heard people say it. I've never wanted to go back there for one day. Or saying, I wish I was older and had this or that done. Just enjoy the journey. Embrace the stage that you're in. Do your best with that while you're there. And a new stage will come. A new stage will come. Find time to be alone with each child. I don't care if you have a dozen children. I think it's really important for you to find time to be alone with each child, free from other distractions. That's one of the very most difficult aspects of good child rearing, in my opinion. In fact, fact, this is one of the things perhaps that separates the good parents from the other parents and the sacrificing parent from the non-sacrificing parent, the most caring from the least caring, parents who set priorities from those who don't. Children today are being influenced by forces outside the family probably more than ever before. Good child rearing takes time, and we have to pay a heavy price for that time. We must find time to spend alone with each child, whether we have one or ten. It's only in this context of being alone without pressure that parents and their child develop that special, indelible relationship which each child so desperately needs to face the life that they're going to live. It's in moments like this that a child remembers what's most important. And it is moments like this that a child remembers later on when life becomes difficult. Most of you know that my wife and I had a son who was killed in a car accident about a year and a half ago. He used to come home late at night sometimes and come into my office where I was working and just sit down and talk for 3 or 4 hours. Those are treasured memories now. That was focused attention. He was, I thought, being prepared for a long life. Didn't turn out that way. But still, I treasure those times. I treasure the memories of the things that we said and thought and did together, just one-on-one. It's also during times of focused attention that parents can take special opportunities to make that eye contact and physical contact with the child. It's during times of focused attention that eye and physical contact have stronger meaning and impact on a child's life. In our families, we need to resist the idea that the squeaky wheel gets greased. If we just say that the squeaky wheel gets greased, if we're always just responding to something that seems urgent or some emergency, then we can easily forget that every child has the same basic needs, whether he demands that they be met or not. And especially vulnerable here is the non-demanding, passive child who is also a middle child. If his siblings happen to be demanding children, then his parents will find it also easy to pass him by until some problem develops, and then he gets negative attention. But he didn't get the positive attention that he really deserved. There seems to be a misconception about too much love being expressed from mother to daughter or from father to son, and that will somehow lead to problems. I don't think that's true at all. On the last day of my 19-year-old son's life, on the day that he ended up dying, and by the way, you can die on any ordinary day. Nobody knew it was coming. But on that last day, I did happen to give him a big bear hug, and I felt his strong, muscular body because he was going to the gym and working out fairly frequently and had really developed himself a lot recently. And he just leaned right into that hug and gave it back to me. I treasure that. I think we need that with our children of either gender. Boys with rejecting, harsh, non-affectionate fathers often do develop problems. One psychiatrist made this statement, and I don't know how far this would go, but the psychiatrist made this statement that I have never known of one sexually disoriented person who had a warm, loving, and affectionate father, end quote. Take that for what it's worth. Now, what about discipline? We've talked about it a little bit. It's definitely a very important part of teaching our children to have a passion for God and live a righteous life. We need to make a child feel loved, and one of the most important parts of that really is the discipline. Discipline is training a child in mind and character to enable him or her to become self-controlled and a constructive member of society and of the Lord's family. Discipline involves training through every type of communication. Punishment is on the list. Punishment is part of discipline, but not all discipline is punishment. Punishment is only one of many ways to discipline. Discipline is immeasurably easier when the child feels genuinely loved. This is because a child that feels genuinely loved generally wants to identify with the parents. Something else we need to do for our children is listening, and I'm calling it active listening because listening should always be active, but I need to put that word in front of it just to show what I'm saying here. Active listening, When a child knows that you understand, or when he believes that you understand how he feels and what he wants, he's much more willing to respond positively to discipline, especially when you disagree with him. If my child knows that I disagree with him and that I'm not going to do what he's asking, that's easier to take if he believes that I understand what it is he's saying and why he's saying it. If he believes that he's not understood, this is where problems often begin. Nothing frustrates a child more than to be told to do something when he feels like his parents don't understand his position. And this is difficult, but it means listening to a child so that he doesn't feel that you have ignored his thoughts and feelings when you use your authority. Use your authority, you must, but use it with finesse. When your child feels that you have considered his position and his feelings, then you can assuage anger and resentment, which could come back to haunt you later. Repeating a child's thoughts and feelings back to him after they have been expressed, I think, is a good way to ensure that he understands that you understand. You don't have to agree to it with him, but repeat his thoughts and feelings back to him so that he knows that you know what he's saying. Really listen to a child when that child is communicating. This is one of the most difficult things that I found to do and that maybe you find to do as well. A parent's worst enemy in raising his child is that parent's own uncontrolled feelings, especially uncontrolled anger on the part of the parent. We've all been guilty of that. If you blow it and make a mistake, then later you need to apologize for that to your child. And good can come from this. Your child already knows you blew it, so you're not giving them new information, but you're letting them know that you know you blew it and that you're willing to own up to a mistake when you've made one. And that's important training right there. It helps them to be better able to admit mistakes when they make them. Anybody can take the switch and beat a child with it as the primary way of controlling that child's behavior. That takes very little sensitivity or judgment or understanding or talent. But the better disciplined a child is, the less punishment is going to be required over time. I've seen the results of the approach of too little spanking, and I think I've seen the results of too much spanking. So we can err in either direction there. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Do not provoke them to wrath. If you want to prevent your child from developing a normal, responsive conscience, which will enable him to control himself, then build your relationship with him only on a punitive basis. Control his behavior primarily by spanking and scolding, but especially by spanking with no other weapons in your arsenal. Spanking has its place, but its place is in the quiver of possibilities, and you as a parent need to know which one to pull out at which time. Always be thinking as you relate to your children, what does this child need from me right now? The younger he is, the less mature he is, and the less mature he is, the more irrational he is. The child knows by nature that he desperately needs your love. He does not by nature know how to try to get it. Punishment should be used as a last resort, but every child, or almost every child, needs this at least occasionally. If a child is genuinely sorry, it's different than if he's not, I think, when it comes to the punishment. And the key word there is genuinely. We must not be manipulated in this. Some children learn to say they're sorry to keep from getting swats. Well, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm sure you've all heard a child say he's sorry when he wasn't, if he thought that he was about to get punished. But genuine sorrow is different from that. And we must learn by knowing our child to distinguish what the difference is. When we relate to our children, we should use requests rather than commands whenever possible. The more parents use authoritative techniques, the less effective they become. What I'm saying is save the big salvos for the important situations. Save extreme forcefulness, which definitely has its place, but save that extreme forcefulness for the time when you really need it. If you're always yelling, then your parent just gets used to that as background, or your child gets used to that as background noise, and if you're not careful, they won't know a real emergency when there is one. I'll give you an example of this since I saw some people walk in over here a minute ago. We were in Pennsylvania. It just happened that John and I were doing some teaching at the same place at the same time, so we were living in the same house for a week. It wasn't planned, at least by us, but it was nice to be living in the same house for a week. This was a few years ago. I don't know exactly how many years ago, but they already had several children. I don't remember how many. And we were walking across a grassy area one day near the community center where the camp out in Pennsylvania was being held at that time, near Bolivar, Pennsylvania. And we didn't realize that there was a road running along. It's just the way the land was, it just looked like the green pasture on as far as we could see. But there was a little road there down just beneath the level of the ice. And you couldn't tell there was a road there, and not being real familiar with the area, none of us had thought about there being a road there. So one of the children in particular, and I don't even remember which one, it doesn't matter which one it was. They probably know which one it was if they remember this at all. But one of the children was just running on ahead on one of those beautiful summer June days in the Laurel Highlands of Pennsylvania. Just makes you glad to be alive when the weather is so nice. One child was running on ahead, and suddenly we started to see a car coming, and then we could see that there was a road running right. The child and this car were on a collision course if they both kept up. So we were sort of stunned by this. John Morris used his big voice to say one word, "Stop!" And that child, I don't even remember which one it was, but that child stopped dead in its tracks. It knew that when it heard that voice and that word, it was supposed to stop. Didn't have to know why. There was no time to explain why. And if that child had kept on going, I hate to think of what could have happened. My point is, if we're always yelling, they're not going to take us seriously when it really should be taken seriously. So that's an important idea, I think. We want to control our child's behavior in the most gentle, most considerate, most loving way we possibly can, while indeed controlling their behavior. So be as gentle as you can and as firm as you need to be. And when you need to be firm, don't back down. When there is defiance on the part of the child, and by defiance I mean when they are openly challenging your authority, you must know that this cannot be permitted. It must not be allowed. When they openly defy your authority, you must win that fight every time, no matter what it takes. Win that fight. I don't care if it takes you an hour by the method you're using. Win that fight. That's not a fight you can afford to lose. I think of a time when Dylan was a little boy. For some reason, he wanted a drawer open and I wanted it closed. Didn't amount to the hill of beans, the issue. The issue was paternal authority. I think it was he wanted it open and I wanted it closed. Either that or the other way. It doesn't matter. So he pulled it open, I shut it, and we went back and forth. But that's not a fight you can lose. You've got to win that no matter how many swats it takes. You know, you got to win that, and you will win it. You're bigger. That's why God made us bigger and stronger than they are. Sometimes it just does take physical force, and there is a definite place for that. I don't want anything that I've said tonight to make you think that I don't believe there's a definite place for that. There certainly is. What I'm saying is use it wisely. Use it with finesse. You can win the fight, and when there is open defiance, then you must win that fight. Developing the appropriate punishment is never really easy, but we must make it fit the offense. If you need time to think about it, my dad used to sometimes just put me in a chair and say, sit there till I figure out what to do with you. Then he'd try to calm down and think about it, and he'd come back and tell me what the punishment was going to be. It's probably better than doing it while you're mad. I know it was better for the child, probably. Although the child sits there and thinks, oh man, what's he thinking up? So that's not fun either, but at least I'm still alive. Children are aware of fairness and consistency. Children know when their parents have overreacted and been too harsh. They know also when you've been too accepting of their poor behavior. Being firm does not equate to being unpleasant. Being firm does not need at all to negate affection. I love you too much to let you get by with that. Eye contact, smile, physical contact, but still a firmness there. The punishment must be severe enough to break a belligerent defiance, but mild as possible while also doing the job. So we parents must possess a foundation upon which to base our lives and which can withstand the test of time. Something that will support us through every phase of living. And that's what we're trying to help our children with. Our children are going to remember their feelings better than they will remember the facts of every situation. They'll remember how they felt about that situation. Teach them spiritual concerns and how to apply those things in everyday life. And I always feel like we're stopping in the middle of something, but it is time to stop. We'll continue with the question sheet that I've been given, Lord willing, on next Wednesday evening, which will be our last session together. I appreciate your kind and good attention. We're going to extend the Lord's invitation as we conclude this evening. If you're outside of Christ and would come to Him in simple, trusting faith, this is one family that none of us ever think. It's too big. If you could be born into God's family tonight by being immersed in water for the remission of your sins, rising to walk in newness of life, you'll have all these older brothers and sisters to help you in God's family. If you have that or anything else to bring to our attention tonight, please let us know by coming to the front seats as we stand together. We'll sing number 633.